Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. From King's College London and the University of Bristol, a study about how an unhealthy diet during pregnancy could be linked to ADHD. And this is published in the Peer Review Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry. So what you eat does make a difference. What you drink makes a difference when you're pregnant. So we should be very conscientious of all this. Also today, I'm going to ask you to listen to someone that we're not hearing these voices at all. Someone, two women, one African-American, one Caucasian, one from West Virginia, one from Texas, both poor as can be. One, the African-American woman, came up with just a single child, and she has some views. Nowhere in the media have I seen any other presentation except those of the people on the streets, and hopefully, and in most cases, protesting peacefully for racial justice, which we should all be conscious of. But then you've got the rioting, the looting, and now you have something I'm seeing that's very ominous. Making pledges of allegiance to an ideology. To me, that's a cult movement. That is not something that should be advocated. And then if you don't agree, then you can be harassed or beaten up or stopped from even going down a street. This happened just yesterday in New York City. I was watching the video of it. I'm very concerned about it. So I want to see what you think on this, but I'm going to give you a different perspective. I believe in showing people, real people in the world. You will never hear either of these people. They're both testifying at a public hearing, two different public hearings, about what it means to be poor. We need to hear these because of the message, two different messages. So I'm going to play those right after Health and Nutrition. And then I'm going to play a clip from a very respected pediatrician about what's known and proven to be in every vaccine and will be in the new vaccines and why it should never be in any vaccine. The evidence is overwhelming of the neurotoxicity of aluminum. And I have a lot of respect for this medical doctor because he's done his homework. So we're going to hear from him. We have a couple more people that you're going to hear from, including... We're going to hear from a Canadian professor signs an open letter criticizing the cancel culture. Also today, if you would like to sign up for the new PRN newsletter, providing your email to prnstudio@gmail.com. This newsletter is loaded with information. We don't promote any religious or philosophical or political agendas. We just look for the truth wherever it is, and always at the cutting edge and always ahead of everyone else. So if you want that on a daily basis, just go to prnstudio@gmail.com, and we'll be happy to give it to you. So we have a lot to share today, and we begin always with the latest on health. So new research led by a scientist from King's College London and the University of Bristol have found that a high-fat, high-sugar diet during pregnancy may be linked to symptoms of ADHD in children who show conduct problems earlier in life. And that's, the study is the first to indicate that genetics are genes, meaning whatever we're doing in our environment or others are doing can impact our genes, changes the way that the developing fetus is conditioned. So early onset conduct problems like lying and fighting and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, are the leading causes of children's mental health referral in the United States and UK. And these two disorders tend to occur in tandem. In fact, more than 40% of children with a diagnosis of conduct disorder also have a diagnosis of ADHD. I personally believe that has been overdiagnosed in many children for the convenience of having children behave in a classroom. But the trouble is, it's not being helped. The medication is like Ritalin. It's a drug that is extremely powerful. It's like methamphetamine in a kid. It's in the same classification as cocaine, by the way. And I've seen the children. In fact, I went to a school down in Florida, northern Florida, interviewed the school teachers, interviewed the children, interviewed the parents. And they said that, you know, the drugs altered the behavior of the children for the worst. And some children tried to commit suicide. So it's common and normal today to have a kid that's on psychiatric medications. That is not normal. And so we should be asking ourselves, what within the new mental health field is legitimate? And how about nothing? You'll see all this laid out in a new documentary. Well, it's new because I'm going to present it for the first time in a near future, but I've been working on it for 8 years. In fact, a lot of you, over 3,000 of you, joined me at the Javits Center when we were there to protest the World Psychiatric Association. And we were across the street, peaceful, but we had people going up to the center with suits on and getting in and then asking, would you be willing to be interviewed? And people came over and they were gracious and we interviewed them. And I would ask them, do you have any scientific proof, any at all, that there is any such thing as a brain chemical imbalance? They said, no. Then do you give drugs for that condition, rebalanced brain chemistry? They said, yes. Then tell me where the cognitive disconnect is here. You're saying there is no such condition, and yet you're giving drugs to treat such condition. And they just shrugged their shoulders. Well, what else are you going to do? So that's how poor the whole perspective of falling into the clutches of a psychiatrist or a pharma-based psychologist who refers people for drugging. And even school teachers today have taken upon themselves to fall in line with, Jimmy, what's wrong? Nothing. Well, something's wrong, Jimmy. You know, you're looking out the window. You better see the school psychologist. Psychologist Jimmy, do you look out the window? Do you fidget? Yeah. Well, clearly you have ADHD or ADD, in which case you need to see the psychiatrist and get on a medication for your own benefit. It's egregious, but that's what's happening. So on top of that, imagine that that can be contributed to the behavior if you feed junk food. Let's go back to Dr. Schollenthauer and Dr. Alexander Schaus. I knew them both. And they were the first, to my knowledge, to bring it to our attention that sugar could cause a hyperactive behavior, an extreme agitation, so people were more argumentative and in a prison system fighting. So they were, talk about really being determined. They managed to get some jails to allow them to control some of the diet, including elimination of all dairy and all sugar. And as a result, the statistics show that violence, mood swings, anger, just drop down to nearly nothing. So sugar is really bad for your brain. All right? And it's bad for the developing fetus brain as well. From the University of Georgia, they have a study about vitamin E, natural vitamin E, improves oxidative and inflammatory responses, meaning it helps turn off oxidative stress in the body. It's a great free radical. Forget that it thins your blood, that's good, and that it's great for your heart and your circulatory system. But now they're saying it can really grab those free radical oxidative cytokines in your body and neutralize them. That's why you should take your vitamin E each day. Also, from the University of Liverpool, published in The Lancet, scientists conducted research from the universities of Copenhagen and the University of Liverpool that shows that adversity in childhood increases the risk of premature death in early adulthood. Now, historically, with the exception of accidents, we never knew anyone in my hometown that died from a heart attack. And yet now that is not uncommon. In fact, what they're saying is children who have experienced repeated serious adversity, that would be like losing a parent or having someone in your family that has an emotional problem or growing up in poverty or being placed in foster care, you have a 450% higher risk of dying in early adulthood than children who have not experienced adversity during childhood. So wouldn't you think that childhood adversity, which is so common to millions of children in the United States, tens of millions, because you got 16 million children alone who are food insecure, that means they go to bed at night and they're not full, they haven't had their food. Now, until you do that yourself, you can't imagine what that's like, and not knowing if you can get food tomorrow. So you have these early life experiences, and it can stick with you. So that's important, all right? So why don't we put some energy into helping children, have a national program to help children. And also from the University of Sydney, study finds fenugreek increases strength and lean muscle mass. That's good. Put some fenugreek. You can get fenugreek powder. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break and come back, and we're going to go right in to this African-American poor woman raising a child as a single mother. Listen to her story, okay?
I don't care to get my address, but I live here in Wichita Falls. I've been living here for over 41 years. So speaking as a black person living in the city, I can honestly tell you the black folks in Wichita Falls don't care one way or another about that monument. That's the reason they're not here. They don't care. Let me tell you a little bit about myself. In 1980, I found myself living in the Ben Donnell Projects on Lincoln Street. A single mother on welfare, having to decide what to do about feeding myself and my son. I couldn't do both at the same time. I had to get on food stamps. But I worked and got better at my job. One of the proudest moments was when I walked into the welfare office and told them, I don't need these food stamps anymore. I can feed myself and my son. Fast forward 38 years. I have retired from another job. I own 17 homes right here in Wichita Falls. Drive part-time for Halcon and run a bed and breakfast. I have made a success out of my life through hard work and perseverance. I want you to know that my success came in and happened in spite of that rock sitting in the front yard of Memorial Auditorium. That monument is just a rock. It's not good. It's not bad. It don't have the ability to be a racist. And it don't have control over anybody. It's just a rock. The issue of removing the statue is a distraction. It's an excuse to dismantle this city. If it comes down, there will be something else and something else and something else and something else to please these terrorist young folks. If black lives matter, then instead of focusing on this rock, let's focus on the black men sitting on the curb in front of Faith Mission every day. Let's make them more self-sufficient. If Black Lives Matter, then you would help Black people in the area of their need, like paying the rent, keeping food on the table, paying the electric bill in this 100-degree heat. That would be more beneficial. These white folks, outsiders, yelling and making their remarks in the street that Black Lives Matter. But you ain't doing nothing about it but opening your mouth and running your mouth. That's all they doing. That's all those outsiders is doing. Your white BLM members is tearing down the city, or wants to tear down the city for their own political agenda. And you got your little black sheeps tagging along behind you. Bad, bad black sheep, have you any wool? Do you have what it takes to ask the question as to why are you following behind these folks trying to bring division and tear down Wichita Falls? These are college-educated people protesting that monument. Can they spend their time instead teaching financial literacy to black people and other minorities? Okay, it makes me mad for a movement to use black people as an excuse for their own political agenda to tear up and tear down. Wherever Black Lives Matter goes, they leave a trail of destruction. Let me say this before I run out of time. I come from welfare to fair and well with that monument in place. Actually, from welfare to millionaire. And never once thought that monument was holding me back. And the news media covering us, fighting over a rock in the front yard. Councilman, don't fall for it. Please don't go for that. These people have a different agenda. And it ain't to help the black people in this town or any minority. Thank you.
Okay. You heard her. You could agree or disagree. But we're not hearing those voices. We're not seeing those discussions. And the people in the street do not speak for everyone. And why is this never a discussion about culture, circumstances, and what has happened to the family? What has happened? She made an interesting point. Where are the people screaming in the streets? What are they doing on a daily basis to give guidance and support, real support, not just filling the air with words, but helping all the people who need a job, who need, an education, or who need some circumstances to change? How about stop gentrifying their neighborhoods? How about helping them? What if you took your five billionaires, they're more African-American billionaires, and what if they just took a small percentage of their money, small percent, and they went into a neighborhood? Take any neighborhood as an example, and with the city's cooperation and their celebrity status, that shouldn't be difficult, and they buy up a whole lot, let's say 5-10-block area, and then they completely construct a new environment, a revitalization zone in every ghetto. This would be the model, and in that that the rejuvenation of that area, you hire people from the neighborhood. You get donors and volunteers, the school teachers, the engineers, the architects, the builders, carpenters, plumbers, and you work together as a cooperative, and you rebuild clinics that they need for their health. You build a clinic to help people get off drugs, clean them up. You help people with affordable housing, that no matter what their income, even on welfare, they would only have to pay 15% to the cooperative to live there. And you make the apartments for families and singles, and you have a general cafeteria that anybody could eat in from that area. You have a park. You have community gardens. You have it solar-powered. You have counseling. You have a daycare center. So all the working parents would have a place that's safe in their neighborhood that would be free to put their children while they're at work. You have humanistic psychology instructors who would help people who are going through some rough times in their life. You would have a holistic assisted living center. You'd have a gymnasium for sports. That's all doable. That could easily be done. And then you use that as a success, as a template for every single community in America, not just African-American communities, all ghettoized communities. Because poverty does not care about your color or your ethnicity, your culture, your background. It can impact everyone. And if you think not, watch Poverty Inc. There's a scene in my documentary, Poverty Inc., where there's an older gentleman and he's sitting on a curb. And I'm down in the street shooting up at him because I wanted to get a sign. There's a big emblem. It looks, imagine the size of a large garbage can lid. But this is a bronze, the same size. And it's about the University of Florida Athletic Center. But there's another building across University of Florida's educational center. He built both of them, his money, north of $150 million. And he mentions, that's me, that's my name. Then we go to his home. His home was, he was sleeping in his former caretaker's garage on a cot. He had lost everything. He wasn't angry at anyone. But interesting, when I reached out to the university and said, since he did so much for you, do you have a room for him? Nope. Wow. I didn't have the heart to tell him that the people you gave all this money to built these wonderful, you know, the science center and medical center and the gymnasium. They won't even give you a room for your largesse. So you see, we should not discriminate about who gets helped when people need help. If someone's down, you don't look at the color of their skin, you don't look at their ethnicity before you reach out a hand. What has happened to us? You help people. You don't judge them. We have no right to do that. We do have a right, a moral obligation, to look beyond color, not be sucked into this idea that I can help you because you're this color or you're Chinese or you're Vietnamese, but I can't help you because you're white. And we know from the new Bible, white fragility, that you're racist. No, that is so wrong. We're spiritual beings. Think on that. Think of how superficial it is and how ill-advised it becomes when you judge someone by the color of your skin. And that's been done throughout history, and it's wrong every time and every place it's done. And we're doing it right now on both sides of the political spectrum. And by the way, for those of you who say, yeah, but it's always worse, tell that to John Johnson, who founded Ebony and Jet through Johnson Publishing, or John Merck, who in 1905 founded Atlantic Life Insurance Company in the middle of segregation, and David Stewart, Worldwide Technology, which is a major IT mammoth, and Henry Jackson, the Millennial Steel Service, and Rich Gardner, Gardner brokerage firm, rags to riches story. In fact, it was he who was portrayed by Will Smith in the film Pursuit of Happiness, and Oprah and Harpo Productions, and Michael Pugh, Carver Federal Savings Bank, the largest black bank in the United States, and Robert Smith, Vista Equity Partners, with 65,000 employees. They're all African American. And they're not alone. If we had to look at all of the people of different races, all ethnicities, all cultures who have contributed to the betterment of all of our lives, my God, I couldn't give all their names and achievements in a week if I did it 24/7. George Washington Carver, in my opinion, the greatest inventor in American history. He died in 1943. He was the pioneer of all agricultural science. He saved the South. And Benjamin Banneker, he died way back in 1806, but he was a mathematician. He created the first functional clock in America. And Rebecca Charles Brooks, the, invented the street sweeper. And Alice Augusta Ball, back in 1916, she developed the treatment for leprosy and Hansen's disease and synthesized the seeds from the hydrocarpus tree. And Leonard Bailey in 1918 invented the folding bed. And Alexander Miles in 1918 invented the automatic elevator doors. And Louis Latimer, in my opinion, the second greatest inventor in history and better than Edison. But he worked for Edison. Edison took credit for that. But he was a genius. He was the drafts person for Alexander Graham Bell and Thomas Edison. Walter Hawkins, the polymer chemist who invented plastic coating for telephone wires. And John Burr invented the rotary lawnmower. And Charles Drew, the physician and surgeon who invented blood banks and blood plasma. And Daniel Hale Williams, the physician back in 1920s actually, who performed the first prototype open heart surgery. And Emmett Chappell, the scientist who discovered the chemicals that cause all organisms to light and emit light. And Garrett Morgan invented the first traffic signal and the first patented gas mask. And Aaron Alcorn invented the X-ray spectrometer. James West invented the electroacoustic transducer microphone, now used in 90% of the world's microphones and camcorders. And Percy Julian, researcher who pioneered chemical synthesis of medical drugs from plants. And Gladys West in the 1930s, the key to development of the GPS satellite technology. It happened then by her. And Eric Jarvis, the Duke neuroscientist on birdsong studies. He's the world's greatest authority on it. And Katherine Johnson, the mathematician with NASA, and was referred to as a human computer, and she headed the calculations that helped land the Apollo 11 on the moon and brought astronauts back to Earth. So these are just a few of the brilliant black women mathematicians. Dorothy Vaughan, NASA's first black manager. Mary Johnson, Christina Darwin, the world expert on sonic boom predictions and wing designs. And Annie Easley, the development of the high energy center upper stage rocket. In every field, Muhammad Ali, Maya Angelou, James Baldwin, Mary Bethune, founder of the National Council for Negro Women in 1935, Ralph Bunchen, the Nobel laureate for his mediation with Israel, Shirley Chisholm, who I mentioned yesterday, James Cone, he was the black liberation theologian at Union Theological, Alexander Crummell, the 19th century minister who traveled the UK and Europe preaching against slavery, and John Coltrane, one of the great jazz musicians and composers ever, Frederick Douglass, W.E. Du Bois, Marcus Garvey, Prince Hall. Now, you might not have known him. He died in 1807, but he was a Boston abolitionist and Freemason who lobbied early for educational rights for black children. Matthew Henson accompanied Robert Perry on 7 voyages to the Arctic. Oscar Michu, who I wrote a lot about, because I got to meet and interview his descendants, and he was the number one black film producer in America. I met him through the black Valentino, Lorenzo Tucker, and his wife. For years, I went every day to Harlem and and to do my research on the book, which was the first book published on Black Hollywood, the history of the African-American experience in Hollywood. I did 20 years apart. That became an important book because it showed the trials and tribulations from going clear back to Step and Fetch It, right up to, you know, the 1990s. But then they had a foothold, and they have now they're being properly represented. And Paul Robeson, what a phenomenal orator and singer and philosopher and political agitator. Those are just tiny infinitesimal amounts. So if we're going to focus all attention on the society's deficiencies that causes breakdown in social structures or educational systems or opportunities, and it certainly has existed, then shouldn't we be even more inspired by these people who took those same systems of limitation and bigotry and prejudice and exceeded every wall built around them and did so under horrific conditions? I think we should pay some attention to those who broke through, and as a result should be a motivation to us that we too, as individuals, no matter what our background and circumstances, we too can break through, because there are others who've done it before us in every field. But to completely deny any of that and not to focus upon the breakthroughs but only the breakdowns and those who have motivated and inspired us and improved all of our lives is to be silent about that possibility and focus all of our angst upon the limitations that still exist. Just some thoughts. Now here's a woman, this is a Caucasian woman, coming from poor in Appalachia. Listen to what she has to say.
Shame on you, and shame on me, and shame on each and every one of us who haven't rattled the windows of these buildings with cries of outrage at a government that thinks their office furniture is worthy of $40,000 a year and families and children aren't. Today I'm here to help you better understand poverty, because poverty is my lived experience. And I'm also here to acknowledge the biased beliefs that poor people are lazy and that poverty is their fault. But how do I make you understand things like working full-time for $10 an hour is only about $19,000 a year, even though it's well above the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour? I want to tell you about a single mom I met who was working at a gas station. She was promoted to manager, and within 30 days, she had to report her new income to DHHR. Within 60 days, her rent bumped from $4.75 to $9.50 a month. She lost her SNAP benefits and her family's health insurance. So she did what poor people are forced to do all the time. She resigned her promotion and went back to working part-time just so she and her family could survive. I can tell you about being above the poverty guideline, nursing my gallbladder with essential oils and prayer, chewing on cloves and eating ibuprofen like they're Tic Tacs because I don't have health insurance and I can't afford a dentist. I have two jobs and a bachelor's degree, and I struggle to make ends meet. The federal poverty guidelines say that I'm not poor, but I cashed in a jar full of change the other night so my daughter could attend a high school band competition with her band. I can't go grocery shopping without a calculator. I had to decide which bills not to pay to be here in this room today. Believe me, I pulled myself up by the bootstraps so many damn times that I've ripped them off. The current poverty guidelines are ridiculously out of touch. The poverty line for a family of three is $21,720. Where I live, because of the oil and gas boom, a three-bedroom home rents for $1,200 a month. So if I made $22,000 a year, which could disqualify me from assistance, I would have $8,000 left to raise two children and myself on. And yet the poverty guidelines wouldn't classify me as poor. I Googled congressman's salary the other day, and according to Senate.gov, the salary for senators, representatives, and delegates is $174,000 a year. So a year of work for you is the equivalent of almost 4 years of work for me. And I'm $24,000 above the federal poverty guidelines definition of poor. It would take nine people working full-time for a year at $10 an hour to match y'all's salary. I also read that each senator is authorized $40,000 for state office furniture and furnishings, and this amount is increased each year to reflect inflation. That $40,000 a year for furniture is $360 more than the federal poverty guidelines for a family of seven. And yet here I am, begging you on behalf of the 15 million children living in poverty in the United States, on behalf of the 1 in 3 kids under the age of 5, and nearly 100,000 children in my state of West Virginia living in poverty, to not change anything about these federal poverty guidelines until you can make them relevant and reflect what poverty really looks like today. You have a $40,000 furniture allotment. West Virginia has a median income of $43,000 and some change. People are working full-time and are hungry. Kids are about to be kicked off the free and reduced lunch rolls because of changes y'all want to make to SNAP. Even though 62% of West Virginia SNAP recipients are families with children, the very same children who cannot take a part-time job because their parents will die without insurance. People are working full-time in this country for very little money. They're not poor enough to get help. They don't make enough to get by. They're working while they're rationing their insulin, and they're skipping their meds because they can't afford food and health care at the same time. So shame on you. Shame on you, and shame on me, and shame on each and every one of us who haven't rattled the windows of these buildings with cries of outrage at a government that thinks their office furniture is worthy of $40,000 a year and families and children aren't. I'm not asking you to apologize for your privilege, but I'm asking you to see past it. There are 46 million Americans living in poverty, doing the best they know how with what they have, and we, in defense of children and families, cannot accept anything less from our very own government. Thank you.
So for those people, like D'Angelo, who now has, in my opinion, the new racist book promoting racism with the cover of anti-racism, promoting fascism with the cover of anti-fascism, how do you take those 46 million people, the new statistics over 66 million, because of COVID, it could go to over 100 million living in abject poverty because they don't have any jobs now, even $10 an hour jobs, because the latest statistics show that 86% of restaurants in New York City did not pay their full July rent, and 37% didn't pay any of the rent, and yet we're into the middle of August, so they can't catch up. They're done. Their dreams are done because we sided with the landlords instead of helping these people. And all we did was a temporary postponement. Okay, you can't be thrown out of your work or your apartment until, and then you have an the landlord. Do you realize how corrupt the whole landlord political system is? New York City is the best example of that. And hundreds of thousands of businesses have closed and employees have lost their jobs because no one protested that inequality and what it meant, because these were not high-profile people, just normal people. So you're going to tell me now that on top of that burden, the burden of what that woman suffers from, imagine being her. You don't know. Do you buy food today or your medicine today? You need them both. And what do you do to pay a bill that you don't have, knowing that you'll be foreclosed on and you have no place to go? And now you want to call that person a racist by birth? My God, we learn nothing from the books like Mein Kampf that destroyed millions of people because of their claim that they were impure and they were corrupt when they weren't. They were neither. They were just human beings who were scapegoated. So we're scapegoating an entire ethnicity, and you don't call that rampant racism? What do you think the consequences is to a person that's already down and nearly out, and now you give them one more kick in the head? My God, what have we become? And most of the protesters that are out there in the streets yelling and screaming racial epithets that if it was anyone else, they would be arrested for, and yet they're championed for it. Many of those are from white privileged backgrounds because their moms and dads had the money to send them to special schools, Ivy League schools, and somehow they feel a right to be the judge of other people. No, you can only judge yourself. And why don't you begin by asking yourself, what have you done to make it a better world today? What sacrifices have you made? Have you stopped eating meat? Have you stopped buying clothes that are made by women in sweatshops? Have you stopped buying your Nike shoes? Have the athletes like LeBron James and Tiger Woods and all the other athletes, have they given back the checks because it was sweat labor that made them and exploiting women? So it's okay to exploit women and have them work at terrible sweat and exploitive wages so you can get your big checks and then go virtue shame everyone else? No. Look in the mirror before you shame others and ask yourself, how complicit are you? We're in troubled times. We're confused by so much, and we shouldn't be. We're all one. We're all sacred souls until we choose not to be. And when we look at someone else as saying, friend, I'm going to treat you like I would want to be treated. I'm going to respect you as I want to be respected. Then suddenly we change the dynamic. We change the formula, the artificial formula of how we've now gotten to where anything can be a microaggression. Any word can cause your cancellation, your job, your career. Just my thoughts. I'd like to hear yours. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. While you're thinking about calling in, what you'd like to share on this, then we're going to have Richard Gale on because Richard wanted to give you some more information about how you can help. And by the way, we were flooded with responses yesterday. We're sending out letters, very polite letters, to all the donors of Wikipedia and showing them this is the true Wikipedia that you don't see. This is behind the scenes. This is what they do. This is these are the reputations they destroy. These are the lies they engage in. This is the bias that is endemic within their skeptic community. This is why anyone wanting information that could save their lives of an alternative, you know, a question, a person has terminal cancer and the doctor says there's nothing can be done. I go to Wikipedia, I Google, you know, terminal cancer treatments, and there are none. Because Wikipedia won't acknowledge Dr. Stanislav Brzezinski and all the other treatments that have saved lives. So what responsibility does an anonymous editor who has no background in the field, knows no one in the field, has never studied the field, has never helped a person, has not been a master of the challenge, how do they get the right to judge everything and everyone a quack? But they do. And so we wrote a letter asking, walk away from Wikipedia. And that letter is being sent out. If you'd like to have your signature on that letter, because we filled up the whole first petition to send it, and now we're sending a second petition out today because we had such a phenomenal response. Richard Gale is here to tell you how to do it. Hi, Richard.
All right. Yeah, no, one of the things is we didn't get a chance yesterday when you made the announcement for people, but the best way to respond if you want to be a signatory on this petition letter, and that is to send an email to Wikipedia Watch. Wikipedia Watch, it's just one word, at protonmail.com. Proton, like the proton electron. mail.com. That's a secure site. It's all encrypted. So it's a protected email. But please, if you have some kind of a professional background, please note that. If you're an RN or you've got some kind of a degree, please make a note of that in addition to your name. The city or town and the state you're from. So just putting up a name without any further information is not that helpful for a petition. So if you did respond yesterday and didn't provide any of that information, please, I'd appreciate if you did so again and just provide that other information that will help us along. Okay?
Good.
That's it. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Richard.
All right.
Now we're going to hear from Dr. Palevsky, Palevsky. I've interviewed him several times. I filmed him twice talking about vaccines. He's very knowledgeable. You won't find any mainstream doctor trying to debate him because he is so knowledgeable. Here's just a short clip, 3-minute clip, of him talking before a commission.
Particle and nanoparticle matter, but the kind of aluminum that we put into vaccines is a different kind of aluminum that we see environmentally. This is called a nanoparticle, and nanoparticles bind really tightly to the bacteria antigens, the virus antigens, the food protein antigens, and any other contaminants that are in the vaccines that we may not know about. And we know that the biochemical properties of nanoparticles is that they are capable of entering the brain. And so we have not evaluated the safety of the aluminum nanoparticle and its injection and where it goes when it gets into the body and whether it gets into the brain. Do vaccine ingredients belong in the brain? No. Do they get into the brain? No one has ever studied it. But animal studies using the same chemicals that are in vaccines that we give to children directly demonstrate that the vaccine ingredients do enter the brain. We are ignoring this information. There are scientists in Europe who've actually done studies on the aluminum nanoparticle and have shown that it can persist in the brain for years and decades. And so what we're seeing is a large outbreak of neurodevelopmental disabilities in adults, including Alzheimer's. And one of the main factors that they're finding in the brains of people with Alzheimer's is the aluminum nanoparticle that's directly related to the vaccines that we're giving. So we have never studied whether the aluminum that we're giving in vaccines gets into the brain, and we've never measured whether it stays in the brain and what it does if it does stay in the brain. But we do know that vaccines are supposed to cause inflammation in the body. But we have more than half of our children with chronic inflamed conditions. And we've never allowed ourselves to ask the question, if the vaccines cause inflammation acutely, do they continue to create inflammation chronically? We have 1 in 5 with neurodevelopmental disabilities, 1 in 10 with ADD and ADHD, 1 in 35 with autism, 1 in 11 with asthma, and 1 in 20 under the age of 5 with seizures. And the autoimmune diseases are exponentially rising, and we are finding that the viruses and the bacteria that we're injecting into the body, along with the adjuvants, create something called molecular mimicry, which means the body sees those viruses thinking that it's foreign, but actually finds pieces of those viruses that match pieces of the self. And the immune system doesn't differentiate between what it's been told to reject and itself. So it will turn the immune system on itself, leading to an autoimmune condition. We know this about hepatitis B. We know it about the Gardasil vaccine. And we know it about the flu vaccine. And we continue to say unequivocally that the vaccines have been studied effectively and that they're safe. And that's just not true.
Okay, good. Remember, that's also going to be true for the new COVID vaccines, plural. There are over 200 in development. And now they say that the most you can expect to be protected by your own antibodies is a maximum of 3 months. Well, knowing Fauci's mind, he'll start advocating, as will Bill Gates, that everybody get vaccinated, let's say, every 3 months. And, well, that doesn't make any sense. I want to share something with you, and this is interesting because it takes a different look. This is a renowned forensic doctor destroys the media's killer virus lies. Here's what he says, quote, "Nobody has died of COVID-19 in Hamburg without previous illnesses." And that's important. So he's a very prominent forensic medicine professor, Klaus Puschel. He has vast experience in autopsying individuals who have died with the coronavirus in Hamburg, Germany. And during an appearance on German television, the professor stunned the audience by claiming that the hysteria over the coronavirus is, quote, completely exaggerated, end quote, as all fatalities, meaning all deaths he examined, had serious previous illnesses which would have soon resulted in death with or without the virus. He stated that there is no, quote, killer virus, end quote. And since the pandemic began, the head of forensic medicine at the University Medical Center Hamburg and his team have been autopsying the people who died in Hamburg in connection with the coronavirus. And according to Puschel, all of the deceased had at least one previous major illness. Quote, even if this sounds harsh, they could have all died in the course of this year, end quote. About 80% of the more than 140 people examined suffered from cardiovascular diseases. The average age of the dead is 80 years of age. And Puschel slammed German Chancellor Angela Merkel's irresponsible and alarmist propaganda towards the coronavirus. Quote, I think it's really completely inappropriate when a president tells his people that we are at war, or when that the German Chancellor compares the situation with that of the last World War, end quote. Healthy people should not be afraid of infection. Quote, the fear that this is a killer virus and that many will die from it is completely exaggerated. We have to make it clear that we don't want to be in a glass case. We can't protect ourselves from everything, and this virus is comparatively low risk, end quote. And anyhow, he went on with a lot to say on that topic, and that's important because we've only been given one part of it. And by the way, to give you an idea, this is from The Guardian, and it says, the U.S. is facing an eviction tsunami. We must cancel rent before it's too late. Houston's rental aid fund was empty 90 minutes after it opened. In Chicago, 80,000 renters applied for 2,000 relief grants. It's already started. A majority of U.S. states have resumed evictions or allowing them despite the worsening pandemic. As many as 40 million people nationwide face eviction due to the inability to pay rent. In comparison, the 2008 foreclosure crisis saw the loss of 10 million homes. Now millions, seniors, people with disabilities, parents, and children are at risk of homelessness. Eviction preys disproportionately in many places, overwhelmingly on black women and people of color, deepening savage racial inequalities. It's not too late to stop this unprecedented eviction tsunami and repair the damage, but we must act boldly. The tsunami is no accident. It's a result of the landlords' lobbying and lawmakers' decisions. Even before the pandemic, 20 million households were struggling to pay rent. On May Day, thousands of renters across the country launched protests demanding the government cancel rent. Instead, Congress has spent trillions bailing out the largest corporations, including private equity landlords, who profited exorbitantly from the pain of the foreclosure crisis and its aftermath. Now, landlords have ramped up eviction filings in anticipation of expiring eviction moratoriums, while tenants have yet to receive unemployment benefits they've been approved for. Canceling rent and mortgage payments acts immediately to match the true scope of the problem. We must protect renters universally by canceling rent for all renters, regardless of income, employment, or immigration status. This eliminates applications, proofs of eligibility, and waits for relief. By protecting all renters, we swiftly aid the most marginalized among them. Universal rent cancellation promotes race, gender, and economic justice because of who renters are, mostly working class or low income and disproportionately of color. In contrast, requiring renters to apply for assistance means that huge swaths of the public will fall through the cracks. Rent relief funds alone cannot resolve the renters' crisis aggravated by the pandemic. They don't fix the fundamental causes behind our lack of housing affordability. And that's the key. Isn't it time that we demanded Congress deal with what is happening in the housing market and also the business market with landlords? I believe it is. And I believe that is a major concern. If not, you're going to have tens of millions of people homeless, hungry, without proper medical treatment or even the medications they need. What do you think is going to be the outcome for them? And how will America suddenly show itself to the world as so uncaring and so distanced from the truth that we need to be empathetic at this moment and reach out and help people? I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.